So this past year, 2021, we did a long haul exploration series called I Doubt It. That ended up having 20 parts or so to it. And I kept observing along the way that series in general are not the norm at the table, and then saying things like, and next week we're going to be exploring part 18 of this series. And anyway, I might have just been in denial about the series thing, but the ideas just kept on coming and they kept on being connected to one another, and so it turned into a long series. And I'm telling you that this morning because I want to start into something today that's probably going to have more than one part to it. But I don't want you to be afraid. Fear not. This is not going to turn into one of those things that lasts for, you know, 2 years or something like that. We have previously touched on some of the ideas that I want to explore over the coming weeks. In particular, in early 2021, I did a talky bit on the idea of what constitutes reality. And that was focused on the notion that reality is what doesn't go away, even if we stop believing in it. So it's not predicated on our belief. And in that particular talky bit, we also just glanced at the thought that reality and God, in terms of language, are pretty decent synonyms, not least of all because our brains are wired to personify what we care about. This is probably one of the more important discoveries about the way our brains work in the last 50 years or so, is that if we don't personify something, it's very hard for us to actually care about it. Highly relevant, for example, to conversations about what we might do to get serious about our part in reducing the impacts of climate change, that sort of thing. Anyway, another topic for another day. But to put it another way, we seem to have a built-in human inclination to treat messages about how reality functions as having the same characteristics we might tend to ascribe to our ideas about the divine. So if, for example, we might have grown up around this idea that God is everywhere, all present, would have been the attribute of God that I would have been taught, for example, one way to understand how that idea got included in our notions about the divine is to consider how it's a personification of nature, which is everywhere, all the time, all present. You know, that whole, there's this phrase, biblical phrase, thus saith the Lord, so it's in the, you know, the King James English. If you grew up around Bible stuff, you might recognize that phrase as words that are attributed especially to the Old Testament prophet Amos. And in the book of Amos, he writes, thus saith the Lord. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff about how if his tribe doesn't get it sorted out and stop messing around with the surrounding tribes and cultures, they're going to start suffering catastrophic losses on the battlefield, and they're eventually going to wind up with nothing to show for their lives but a pile of ashes. A house burned to the ground, as one translation puts it. Now, if you grew up around that kind of stuff, you might also have been taught to imagine God as a person, as an individual. And there's a reason why so many of us find ourselves able to use personal pronouns or metaphors for God without thinking twice about it. We can just attribute human characteristics of the divine as though it was a matter of course. And that is because, among other things, the people who taught us chose to read ancient stories as literal descriptions of how things are rather than as ancient mythology. And again, mythology doesn't mean story that isn't true. It means, as I'm using it, narrative that puts us in accord with reality, or guiding story, stories that help us make sense of our lives and the world around us. It's a way of looking at reality and trying to understand how it works and what that means for us as humans. Now, not surprisingly, that also means that as our knowledge of how things work grows, it impacts the stories that we consider useful for explaining reality. So we adjust those things. So when we read Amos writing, thus saith the Lord, if we've been taught to think about the divine as a person, then we might picture, you know, this deity as a, you know, old guy with a beard or whatever. That might be what we think of when we hear a phrase like, thus saith the Lord. Not actually probably the best way to think about what Amos was actually doing. We would probably be better served by imagining a different old guy, Amos, in this particular case, not God, sitting in his abode in about the 8th century BCE, and he's dictating to a scribe what he sees around him and how he thinks it all works. And then he's personifying his understanding of the cosmos, of the greater scheme of things, and he's using that personified language to anchor his narrative of reality, of the way things are. And that's where he comes up with a phrase like, thus saith the Lord, thus saith reality, thus saith my best shot at how the world around me works. Now, through that lens, a phrase like, thus saith the Lord, could be fairly understood as Amos's take on thus saith reality. From Amos's perspective, working with the knowledge he had and his beliefs about what that knowledge meant, the reason his tribe wasn't thriving is because they were dallying with neighboring cultures, including their religions, including those neighboring tribes' narratives for reality, which were not the same as Amos's tribe's narrative for reality. And because Amos has this picture of divine reality or God being capricious, jealous, sort of baseline angry, needing blood sacrifices, for example, just to be kept from destroying people, because he has that running in the background, he evokes that narrative to explain reality and what he believes the people should do. We work with what we know. So Amos evokes this narrative of keep your God happy, or the rest of reality is going to land on you like a ton of bricks. And in this particular case, that landing on you like a ton of bricks is going to take the form of a violent takeover by the neighboring tribes and their gods, leaving you with nothing to show for your life's work. So that's his concern. And that's how he explains it. Now, from that sort of vantage point, it might be easy to dismiss Amos's take on reality, and with it, his take on the nature of the cosmos and the divine. But from a 21st century perspective, from where we sit, there's some newer information to take into account that makes this all pretty fascinating and relevant from a different perspective to our current reality. So in a community like The Table, which includes lots of different perspectives on the mysteries that we continue to explore as humans, I think it might be helpful to know that Amos and the ancient Hebrew writers that followed him, and Amos is generally acknowledged as one of the earlier prophetic Hebrew writings that we have access to, that all of those people wrote during a period of history where religions were being constructed left, right, and center. And not just in that part of the world where Amos was, but all over the developed, all over the world. Careful with my language here. Everywhere there were humans making culture in this period, religions were being developed. It's a period that's generally called the Axial Age, and it's a period when roughly at the same time around most of the inhabited world, the great intellectual, philosophical, and religious systems that came to shape subsequent human society and culture emerged. That in itself is rather fascinating. In our explorations here at The Table, we often reference the emergence of big ideas in what we typically call Western thought and worldview, sort of inversions of reality that have predominantly shaped the culture many of us grew up in and much of the cultural reality in Europe, and because of colonization and the exploration of the Europeans, also on this side of the Atlantic. Now, here's one of the things that's fascinating about the Axial Age. During this period, not only were the ideas central to Greek philosophy and worldviews being formed, but also the Indian metaphysicians and logicians. Those are the folks who articulated the great traditions of things like Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism. During that same period, Persian Zoroastrianism, the Hebrew prophets, people like Amos, and the hundred schools, most notably Confucianism and Taoism of ancient China. All of those systems of thought and belief developed during this period in history. And that's not an exclusive list by any means. Those are sort of just the greatest hits, if you will. So, for instance, the fact that that list is not exhaustive, by way of considering that, it's an interesting and I would say important matter to consider the formation of what we might now think of or speak of here in this continent as indigenous spiritualities, values, and cultures relative to this axial period. Anyway, the phrase itself, axial, originated with a German psychiatrist and philosopher, a guy named Karl Jaspers. And Jaspers noted that during this period of history, there was a shift or a turn, as if on an axis, hence axial, away from more predominantly localized concerns and toward transcendence. And you can hear that in the words of someone like this early Hebrew prophet as he wrestles with trying to articulate his own emerging understanding of how a personal deity, the Hebrew take on God, might be mixing it up with the events or the realities being experienced by his own little underpowered and increasingly fragmenting tribe. There's a fascinating parallel here between this and some of those hundred schools philosophies that came out of China, ancient China, because ancient China was fragmenting as well at the same time. And you can hear in those developments of those systems of thought and belief attempts to pull the people together. I'm not going to get into it in detail, but one thing that Amos is trying to account for is the way that the Hebrews were starting to behave a lot like people in a two-party political system. They were starting to treat their fellow tribespeople as enemies. They were dividing the country up into separate kingdoms and so on. And Amos is doing his dead-level best to find a story that's going to help everyone pull together, just like lots of us are doing these days. And he's essentially saying to his people, unless we get our act together and start to behave in accordance with reality, we, our culture, our civilization, our personal homes, our property, our families, we are going to cease to exist. Now, I think that's already pretty interesting, but what makes it more intriguing to me, and I believe profoundly relevant to exploring what we believe, is that these ideas are not at all unique to Amos and to the Hebrew people. That observation of Carl Jaspers that it's during this historic period that thinkers are turning away from predominantly localized concerns and toward transcendence, that's happening sort of all over, where culture is being made all over the world, I think that's fascinating. Now, the period in question, the axial period, when you're defining something like this, the borders of it are a little bit arbitrary and a little bit loose, but generally speaking, that period is understood to be from 800 BCE to about 200 BC, and Amos, for context, is writing at around 750 BCE. So, in the early part of the axial period, but definitely within it. To come back to this idea of transcendence for a little bit, transcendence literally means to go beyond. So all over the world, during this period of history, 800 BCE to about 200 BCE, in ways that don't have any confirmable evidence of significant cross-pollination, so it's not like these thinkers were communicating with one another or cultures were communicating with one another, during that period, separate from one another's influence, for the most part, thinkers were shifting their ideas about the cosmos and how it works and what that might mean for us as a species. That's pretty interesting. They were turning away from mostly offering explanations that focused on the local, and they were turning toward explanations that looked beyond that frame of reference to account for what was going on and also for how things were likely to go in the future. This is happening all over the world at the same time. There's a Canadian philosopher and sociologist named Charles Taylor, who spent lots of time thinking about the axial period, and he suggests that during this period, going beyond or transcendence had several meanings. And just a quick note here, before we kind of consign all of this to, the garbage can of dusty historical minutiae, it's worth remembering that the ideas that emerged during this period are the ones that still predominantly shape the world we live in today. We are still working with these quite some time later. Taylor says that one of the key pivots, one of the key axes during this time was to thinking about the cosmos and the way that it works instead of just taking for granted that it works. So where before the axial period people might have gone, it is what it is, during this period people started to think about why is it the way that it is and how is it and to try to get behind it. And so in other words, we as humans started to realize that we could actually meaningfully examine the wider environment in which we live, and we could know something about its workings, and we could take that into account when we formed our notions or our definitions of reality. Now, this is also the period, Taylor suggests, that gave rise to second-order thinking, about the way that human beings even think about the universe in the first place and come to know it. In other words, we started during this period to consider how we come to know things. Not just we know them, but how do we come to know them? Why do we seem inclined to look beyond ourselves for meaning? And how do those pieces fit together rather than just examining what we know? So it's during this period where we started to think about those other aspects of this. And by the way, second or third order or subsequent order thinking is often where things start to really change. Because rather than just sort of accepting the way things are, we start to get beyond that and go, what are the implications of this? What are the reasons behind it? And that starts to really shift the way we look at the things that are all around us at reality. So that's two shifts. The third shift or pivot in this period is away from merely propitiating tribal or civic deities, Taylor's language. Taylor characterized that as, he called it feeding the gods. And so there's a shift away from that and towards speculation about the fate of humanity, about human beings' relationship with the cosmos, about the good as a concept, and about how human beings can be good. So previous to this, we don't encounter much of that kind of thinking in the record of what humans were reflecting on. That the good as a concept, how human beings could be good, how what's our relationship with the cosmos, what's the fate of humanity, and how do we work with that? Not really on the radar before this period. That's a big shift, right? Now, if you read the book of Amos, which, what are the odds? But if you read the book of Amos with this information in mind, it's pretty fascinating to hear that writer trying to plug those emerging sensibilities and ideas into what he sees happening to the people and the culture that he cares about all around him. Once you read that, aware of what's happening during the period where Amos is writing, it's fascinating, because you can almost see him squirming mentally and kind of going, yeah, but what about, and what if, and then if we did this, would that happen? And you can just kind of, it's all over there. So Amos is still very much embroiled in a religious system that is concerned with keeping the local deity happy. Which is why he equates keep the religious rules with win when you go to war, right? Because keeping the religious rules, keeping the sacrifices coming in this particular case, in this system, continuing to spill blood is what keeps that, that's their notion of how you keep the deity happy. Then what happens if you keep that system intact and in good repair and follow the rules? You win when you go to war because, God's on your side, right? So he's also starting, though, to wrestle with, and you can see it in the writings, he's also starting to wrestle with what it means to be good and what being good might have to do with keeping the religious rules, not just keeping the deity happy. Anyway, it's not very nuanced yet in Amos, but you can see in there the nascent ideas that evolve further in the notions that later Jewish thinkers come up with and that Jesus is working with in his own teachings and ideas, introducing concepts like forgiveness or grace, which are much more evolved and nuanced ideas than just feed the God when at war. Now, this is interesting. Given that all of this consideration of transcendence was happening at around the same period of history, but in lots of different geographic and cultural realities, one question that sort of obviously emerges is to consider what sort of ideas emerged and whether they had anything in common. Because again, remember, we don't have any significant evidence of cross-pollination here, of ideas traveling from region to region or thinker to thinker. The general consensus is that there's a lot of originality, so different takes on things, but also a lot of commonality in the systems of belief that emerged during the axial period and that we are still, millennia later, working out the implications of. I'm going to give a couple of examples. So during this period is the time when Indian thinkers came to think of karma, the residual effects of past actions, as having direct impact on human life, and during which they proposed solutions for how human beings could attain liberation, moksha, from karma's effects. So that happened during the axial period in what we now would think of as India. In ancient Greece, Socrates is sort of the best known example, but there were lots of folks who were kind of doing this similar work. Socrates is the best known example of thinkers that emphasized the use of reason in the relentless investigation of truth. And his student Plato, who is arguably the father of Western philosophy, adapted his teacher's insight in theorizing how the world of everyday existence and the eternal world of ideas interrelate. Pretty easy to spot the legacy of that in what we do here at the table every week, right? Like that's very, there's almost a straight line between those sometimes. In ancient China, Chinese thinkers were striving to unify the kingdom, as I mentioned before, and they're trying to avert a civil war. And in that process, they dispute and they debate what might be the appropriate way or Dao for human society. And they came up with a range of answers to that question of what might be the appropriate Dao. So the disciples of Confucius, for example, argued that the Dao consisted in promoting a humane civilization. While the disciples of thinkers such as Zhuangzi took the cosmic Dao, or the way of the cosmos as evident in nature, as the guide for life. And so there were various sort of outcomes from that deliberation and debate. The tradition of Zoroastrianism. Zarathustra, this is interesting because maybe during this period, certainly some during this period, but Zarathustra as a character, huge range of possible dates. Anyway, during the axial period, we can see that that Zoroastrianism conceived of human history as a microcosm of the cosmic struggle between good and evil, and their notion was that each human life was a constant living out of this struggle between choosing between good and evil. So that's their take on that. That's during the same period, as I also mentioned a moment ago, that the Hebrew prophets came to view the God of their nation as the God who created heaven and earth and who shaped the destiny of all people. And you can easily see how this produced the narratives we find in the poetry of Genesis, for example, the story about how humans got here, or actually more than one story in those poems, but we've sort of, you know, it's sort of sifted down over time. That's where we find this particular story about how humans got here, why we struggle to be good, where God fits into the whole scheme of things. So that all develops in that part of the world during this same period of history that these other ideas about reality are being developed in other parts of the world. Now, I think that's a pretty interesting combination of specific to place and people, yet also overlapping in that all of these representatives that we've just cited here saw themselves as suggesting solutions to life's questions and problems, not just to their tribe's questions and problems, but to all of life's questions and problems. That's a huge shift. Now, their investigations might have been framed as local and tradition specific. See Amos. If we don't do this, we lose against the neighbors. Stop going to visit right after that thus saith the Lord phrase. He's like, stop going to this town and stop going to that tribe. It's like it's super local. But their concerns, the things they're dealing with, the way they're talking about humans' relationship to the cosmos and to the divine, that is global and maybe even universal. So, here's a question for all of us to consider as we enter a new calendar year. Is there a chance that we are, right now, as a species, on the brink of a new axial age? Do you think there's any possibility that a community that exists to explore what we believe, as we do at the table, might be participating in a wider human project that is rapidly gaining momentum around the world? In this past Sunday's And Lunch After Zoom gathering, we got into quite a conversation about technology and its impact on our development as people, and there were some particular parts of that conversation that were focused on the development of our littles, of our young people, but that wasn't exclusive. It was about the impact on all of us. And in retrospect, as I reflected on it, I feel like our conversation that day held elements of the two most broadly drawn opinions about whether our species is possibly in the early stages of a new widespread pivot in how we explore what is beyond us or the transcendent. On the one hand, it would be hard to deny that technology has radically transformed the ways that we both individually and communally live our lives, interact with culture, communicate, and perceive the world around us. In addition to that, individualized forms of religiosity and spirituality have become much more prevalent, particularly as traditional institutionalized religions have declined in membership and prominence in most of the industrialized nations since the mid-20th century. We are, generally speaking, more and more at ease with describing ourselves as spiritual but not religious. For some observers, this is all cause for great concern and the lament that we are losing touch with binding narratives or shared stories that help us make sense of the world has some folks, clearly predicting the world's end. On the other hand, many express hope and even confidence that the next transformative period of human life will prove to be as lively and creative as the previous one, the one that produced so much that is good, which we enjoy day by day, while simultaneously generating things that are fearsome, and this sense of pending widespread change that is both much needed but also often much feared. That's an interesting space. That's an interesting space in which to be a community that exists to explore what we believe. Personally, I come down on the hopeful side of this. Not because I can't imagine catastrophic events being part of the process or sort of seismic shift, by which I don't mean something literal in this case, although of course also perhaps literal seismic shifts. But what I mean by that is large movements of how we understand the world around us, and the resulting impact of those kind of movements in human ideas tends to be shifts in culture. And shifts in culture, of course, are made by people and they impact people. So there's something fearsome about that, I think, to be honest. We don't tend to like change. We don't tend to find it easy. It's disruptive, generally speaking. It's also how things move forward. It's also changes how change happens, at the risk of saying something that sounds kind of stupid. Without changing something, nothing changes. You know, that sort of paradigm for personal growth. Also true for cultural growth. And we've got a lot of new information about the world that we're in to take into account. What I want us to try to keep in view, and why I wanted to reference an Old Testament prophet, which is not something I do very often, is because in those writings, which have, in some instances at least, been sort of calcified, they've been treated as all done, a last word about something, thus saith the Lord. If we look at those and understand them to be the products of, among other things, the axial period, when many people were shifting their understanding of what it means to be human in the cosmos, that work has never stopped. That's one of our great human projects. It's just that some of those ideas that came out of that previous axial period were so substantial and had such enormous implications that we've been working with them for a couple thousand years. What if we're entering a new axial period? What if we are at the table when we explore what we believe, participating in that same, if you will, caliber of project or magnitude of project? What if the ripples from that could produce those kinds of scales of change over the next millennia? Would that change the way we explore what we believe? Would it change our motivation for exploring what we believe? Would it add sort of fuel to the positive fire of exploring what we believe, to the passion about it? I realize those are not questions you just check off an answer to, but there are things to muse about, and to me, they sound like really good reasons to keep exploring what we believe. I'm so glad we get to do this together. I'm so glad I get to do it with all of you. I love our conversations, and I look forward to many more. I'm going to leave it there for today. And when we get to part 40 of this series, you can tell me I was wrong, that it lasted way too long. And I'll take it. All right. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you. Bye for now.